I don't think he's really concerned about what I'm thinking. They've got it all figured out. He moves like he's standing still, but when he walked, it was almost like he had two really bad knees. He was hobbling almost, shifting his weight to the left and right. Almost rocking back and forth. And he drags his feet a little bit. I mean, I don't know whether they're feet or their boots. They're almost white. They're not like his head, his face. They're shaped like cat's eyes, very almond shaped. I don't see any toes or anything, but the almond shapes are pointed in the front and the back so that, they're kind of club feet. Yeah? Skinny ankles, legs. Really skinny. Not bony, nothing like that, but he's so little. And I think he's just as interested in me. No, I mean, I don't feel threatened at the moment. I'm kind of looking at his feet and he kind of looks back. Just to sort of check on where I am. Make sure I don't go anywhere. Arms, too, really skinny, like he has no biceps. He's got almost no shape. He's kind of straight down, kind of almost flat. I'm really afraid to look at him. I don't want him to think I'm being aggressive. And, his shoulders, they're really square, but they're really small. Skinny. And he has a neck, but it's small, like the rest of him. Skinny. His chin is really pointy, too. I don't see any ears, although there's something there. There's a slit where his mouth should be, but it's not open, just kind of across. He absolutely does not change expression. I'm kind of, I feel like, if only my friends could see me now. I don't think, but it's okay, I can handle this. I'm doing okay, just watching him. I look back at the car and now another part of the car is lit up, the part of the right side of the car that I'm looking at. Yeah, the light's all over. Then he looks over, the boss there, he looks over my head, cause it's something moving down. There's a light moving or something moving that's really bright, and the shadows change. That guy is still digging. God. What is he digging for? He's digging with something he's got in his hands. It's not easy for him. I'd offer to help him, but I have the feeling it would cause problems. And then there's another guy in front of him, watching him. They all look kind of alike. I mean, they're all small and whitish and not real coordinated. They're kind of fumbling at things. I think he's having trouble digging. God. I mean, talk about an unlikely place to dig. It's right near the road. Not even a field or grass or anything. Just ugly, blackish, grayish dirt. It's getting deeper. He's digging a hole. He sure is. Yeah, it's like a foot deep. I can see that. He's still digging. At this point, it was obvious to the three of us that, despite his deep trance state, Stephen was resisting moving ahead in his narrative. He seemed to be deliberately avoiding any recall of what happened next, and was, in effect, marking time by dwelling on details of the moment. Ted signaled Dr. Claymore and she began to bring him out of the hypnotic state, assuring him that he would easily be able to integrate these newly conscious memories into the texture of his life. It had been a long, illuminating session, though the tension had been emotionally draining. Today's most important revelation was the sense we had of a consistent, though still, unfolding, sequence of events. 7 months before, we knew that Steve's car was stopped alongside the road, and that he had stepped outside of it, a piece of the story to which I will attach the letter B. Letter A, how the car came to stop in the first place, we had not known until today, accompanied as it was by his description of the involuntary swerve at high speed, as if a huge magnet just sucked it over to the right. As he stood by his car, C occurred. He saw and heard the still, mysterious black leather objects. And then D, the approach of the white creatures. Interestingly, in today's retelling he did not include their actual arrival on the scene, an obviously extremely frightening moment which he had recalled vividly in the earlier session. This time, he began with their presence as a fait accompli and coupled it with a new detail, the repeated, calming message, There are other things standing around me, there's nothing to be afraid of. This situation, E, immediately follows D, their arrival. Stephen moved on to F, the episode of the figure digging while he was somehow held motionless. G we will designate as the placing of the clamp on his shoulders, another part of the story omitted here, and obviously another particularly terrifying memory. So, one could say, his first hypnotic session dealt with B, C, D, and G. 7 months later, we learned of A, some new details of C, and D and F, a perfect narrative dovetailing. On a smaller scale, other revelations served to illuminate a few unexplained and dangling memories from before. In May, Stephen recalled bending down, perhaps to turn on the car's interior light, for a reason he could not supply. I have a strange memory of looking at the dashboard. I don't know if I was looking at the clock or not, but I remember seeing it, and I don't remember why. In his later session, this apparently inconsequential act was again described. I'm reaching down for something. I dropped something, or I'm adjusting the seat or doing something. That's when I see the car light go on. I'm reaching with my right hand. Minutes later, the significance of his move came back with a shock. I know. Oh, God, I see two lights in the sky when I'm driving. I'm hunched over, looking up. It's a reflection in the windshield, and then I turn the light on to see if it's still there. And it is. Stephen's recall was so vivid because it was the moment he first saw the UFO flying overhead. His instinct was to try to convince himself it was only some kind of reflection, but his flicking on the interior light told him otherwise. A few days after his appointment, I phoned Steve to ask how he was, and what he was thinking in retrospect. I told him that it had seemed during his hypnosis that he was reluctant to move ahead in his recall. That's true, he said, in his characteristic shy, understated tone of voice. I didn't want to go any further. I'm afraid the worst is still to come. The hypnotic process apparently contains its own built-in safety valve. Subjects usually recall only what they can handle comfortably at that moment. There seems to be a careful, unconscious doling out of disturbing material, and despite moments of near panic, such as Stephen experienced during both sessions, the mind is able, self-protectively, to shut off the flow. At this point in our investigation, Stephen Kilburn's account paralleled many other abduction reports, such as the Betty and Barney Hill case, in precise ways, but there was one basic and striking deviation from the model. In every case I had ever heard about, the witness or witnesses consciously remembered at least seeing a UFO. The odd circumstances, such as a period of lost, unaccounted for time, that accompany such a UFO sighting are what alert investigators to the possibility of an abduction. Stephen had nothing more to go on than a vague feeling that something he could not remember happened to him one night on a particular stretch of highway. Since beneath these feelings there turned out to be, indeed, a UFO abduction, how could one guess how many other abduction experiences lay buried and ticking within how many other unconscious minds? The prospect was staggering. If it happened once, it could happen 10,000 times and no one would necessarily ever know. Months after Stephen's second hypnotic session, Ted Bloch told me about a California case that had recently surfaced. It had not been made public, and he had only learned of it through private communication with one of the investigators. On November 26, 1972, a young legal secretary named Judy Kendall Ten and her sisters, Dannon and Becky, visited their grandmother in the town of Bodega Bay. They left at 6 p.m. for the two-hour return trip, and arrived home at midnight, 4 hours late. Their parents had already called the state police, fearing their daughters had been involved in an accident. The girls had no explanation for their delay, though they reported a peculiar detail. Dannon and Judy both remembered driving over the same bridge twice, but in the same direction. They passed the flashing yellow light at Cache Creek Bridge, continued on their way, but felt confused as to where they were or what was happening. Then they passed the same flashing light and crossed the bridge, and shortly thereafter arrived at home. There seemed to be no explanation. They definitely weren't lost, since they knew the territory well. The car, for that matter, did not have enough gas for a 6-hour drive. The strange episode was put aside by all three women until a sequence in a movie 3 years later re-established the incident. Julie was watching Escape to Witch Mountain, and at one point in the film an RV, a van, supernaturally lifts off to the sky. Judy felt oddly uncomfortable, recalling the sensation of being in her own car and somehow floating. Her sister Dannon, sitting beside her in the theater, felt the same unease. It was clear to both of them that this disturbing half-memory was connected with their peculiar experience in 1972 when they lost 4 hours driving back from Bodega Bay. Again, Judy put the mystery out of her mind until 1977 when, after visiting a friend near Yolo, California, she sighted a UFO on her way home. It was a typical distant nocturnal light. When she told her friend about it, she was urged to report it to the Center for UFO Studies. Her friend asked if she had ever figured out what had really happened in the Lost Towers incident 5 years earlier, and when Judy said she still did not know, the friend suggested she also report this episode. Dr. Harnick at the center was curious. In 1977, Judy was hypnotized, and the story that emerged was similar in many details to Stephen's. The first odd thing that she recalled was her car somehow not responding to her control, but moving of its own accord, as if it were not actually on the ground. Later, this dialogue ensues: Dr. McCall, what can you see? JK, I think I see a transparent head shape thing, with funny looking eyes. I don't want to see it. Dr. McCall, why don't you? JK, it scares. Dr. McCall, what's happening now? JK, sobbing, coming towards me. It scares me. Dr. McCall, where are you, Judy? JK, I don't know. I don't know. I'm scared. I don't want to see it anymore. Dr. McCall asked her to describe her captors' heads. They look like ordinary people's heads, but they don't have any hair. No hair anywhere. Their cheekbones are funny looking. Their skin is kind of white and milky. I don't remember seeing a mouth. I don't see any ears. All I see is holes. Inside the UFO, Judy recalled seeing three distinct types of creatures, one of which, a woman, seemed entirely human. The description immediately above, taken from the transcript of her hypnosis, describes what seems to be the same white, skinned, hairless type that Stephen remembered. At the time I first heard about the Kendall case, its most striking similarity to Stephen's was the fact that neither Judy nor Dannon Becky apparently was asleep throughout the encounter, had any conscious recollection of a UFO sighting. The Kendall and Kilburn cases, one could guess, came to light only because of an unlikely series of accidents: Stephen's chance meeting of Ted Blocher, his relocation to New York, etc., and Judy's having seen Witch Mountain and later having a UFO sighting, which she reported to the center. The unmistakable deduction to be drawn is that we had happened to notice the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Other similarities between the Kendall and Kilburn cases eventually came to light, but there is one detail that should be mentioned here, and that is the question of the two automobiles appearing to be under external control. In hundreds of UFO encounters, drivers have reported that their electrical systems have failed and their engines have died, only to come back on as if by magic when the UFOs depart. More startling still are the reports, which probably by now also range in the hundreds, of automobiles literally lifted off the ground and moved, with driver and passengers inside. Stephen could not understand how his car, traveling downhill at about 70 miles per hour, could make a violent right turn without rolling over, moving as if sucked by a giant magnet. Betty Hill, under hypnosis in 1964, described her experience this way: we're driving along on a tarred road and all of a sudden, without any warning or rhyme or reason or anything, Barney made a, he always, the brakes squealed, He stopped so suddenly and made this sharp left-handed turn off the highway. In a case I investigated in late 1978, two nurses in central Tennessee were stopped late at night at a village traffic light. A large domed craft landed on the road ahead of them and D.S., in the driver's seat, was startled when her vehicle began to move without her pushing gas or anything, or accelerating the car. They traveled about 500 feet before the car halted all of a sudden, and the motor just kind of stopped. 11 In another episode, Chandra Larson 12 and a friend were abducted in 1975. Under hypnosis, she said that, when the UFOs, there were several, landed, the car stopped automatically, and that she had the sensation of floating. I saw the car being brought right up to it, like the car was pulled. A witness in an Alaskan case noticed that her car was driving itself. She could neither guide it, nor accelerate, and they proceeded for many miles at 25 miles per hour, a period during which the car apparently used no gasoline. 13. Less lucky were the terrified women in the Casey County, Kentucky, abduction of January 6, 1976. The three friends noticed a blue light behind their automobile just as it began to escape their control. The speedometer was registering 85 miles per hour, though the driver had her foot off the accelerator and was crying for help in steering the car. The women experienced a burning sensation in their eyes, followed by more excruciating pain, and then the inexplicable sense of their car being pulled backwards. When they finally reached home, they discovered an hour and a half of missing time, and through hypnosis their abduction and examination aboard a landed UFO was uncovered. If an abduction case contains, let us say, 100 separate bits of information, probably 80 of them can be found in previously investigated cases, but 20 information bits will be new. The phenomenon repeats itself, but never exactly. The shapes cohere, but without forming an identical pattern, and in a strange way these new details add credibility to each case. Getting through to buried traumatic material by means of hypnosis is usually a time-consuming, laborious undertaking. Drive Claymore has described the process of slowly uncovering the core memories as being a little like peeling an onion. Layer upon layer must be patiently stripped away. By the fall of 1979, Stephen had consciously recalled a few later events from his experience, including the sense that he had been examined by his captors inside 77, the UFO. From the moment he first realized that his encounter had included an involuntary physical examination, he had avoided pursuing the matter through hypnosis. So reluctant was he that he was not ready to explore it specifically until January of 1980 in his fourth hypnotic session. The third session, in February of 1979, was recorded by an NBC film crew and will be discussed in Chapter 5. It did not reveal many incidents not already known from the two earlier hypnotic regressions. In the fourth session, Dr. Claymore instructed Stephen to imagine himself in a spacious movie theater, feeling relaxed and very comfortable, and about to view film concerning his experience on the Pikesville Road in Maryland, an experience which affected his shoulder. His memories began as he stood beside his car, facing his white, skinned captors. His nervousness was palpable, and the first image clearly frightened him. "S.K., when I first see it, it scares me. All by myself. That's why I'm hesitating." "A.C., reassuringly, you can watch as much as you care to watch. Turn it off whenever you want to." "S.K., chuckles, "I may not be watching it today." A long pause follows. "I see the, I don't know what it is, a long clamp kind of thing. And there's a joint in the middle like an elbow, almost like an arm, and it's, around my shoulder. And I see it just holding me, over my right shoulder. It's connected to this, I don't know what this is. It looks like a saucer, that's what it looks like. It's whitish. And it's sitting on something, looks like it's white also, a kind of platform. It looks like an erector set or something, some kind of girders, criss-cross, latticework, it sits on. Like an egg sitting on it, and, I see the car. Deep sigh, it's holding me, if it grabs me, I feel, it hurts my back, my lower back on the right side. AC. After a long pause, what happens next? Films have a continuity, Stephen. She prods his memory very delicately. SK, they're watching me now. They're standing there watching me, and the one guy starts motioning, now starts walking past me, on my right, and he goes in back of me and, dot. Sighs, and he's looking inside the thing. AC, SK, AC, SK, and he turns me around slowly. I don't think I could move if I wanted to. That thing is really on my body. And he's, just standing there, and I'm turned now, looking at the thing. And he's looking inside and it's dark. I can't see what's in there. My back hurts. Breathe into your back. You can make that pain disappear. Dr. Claymore instructs Stephen in ways to overcome the pain. After a long pause, they want me to come in. It's a ramp, a little ramp. He wants me to walk up before him. And, I think there's some kind of noise. I'm not sure I even hear it. It's like, it's coming from the thing, whatever it is, the saucer. I think the whole thing is vibrating, but it doesn't look like it's moving. It's like a very, very quiet hum. The thing pushes me in. Chuckles, you'd think they'd realize I was going. And, now he's alongside me at my left, and there's a passageway. It's round. Almost like a tube we're walking through. The thing's not on my back anymore and I'm very relaxed. They're not going to hurt me. I want to look back, but I feel like I'm almost paralyzed. It doesn't hurt, though. I'm just very relaxed, very calm. We make a right turn. It's funny, this thing didn't look that big from the outside. Didn't look like there was that much room in it. And now we're coming back. Chuckles, I think we went the wrong way. Now, I don't think he knows which way to go, what to do now, and he looks at me. I wasn't looking at him. Sighs, I'm not really afraid of him, but I'd like to know what he's thinking. Now we go back, yeah, to that right turn where he turned me around. We turn around again, we're in the passageway at the right and we go into a room, and the door closes behind us. This room, it's all white. It's almost the color of the outside of the ship, whatever the thing is, the saucer. It's, oh, my back. Just breathe deep into your back and the pain will diminish, etc. Shouts, oh. They put a thing on my back. I'm sitting on a table in the middle of this room. Oh. Arches back, as if in pain. Oh, oh. Arches back. When I think about what they did, it really hurts. AC. Calming him again with instructions to overcome the pain. SK. Rapid breathing. Obvious signs of distress. This room is, whitish. It's really big. It's curved on the inside. The walls aren't. I don't think there are any angles in the room. That's what it is. Everything looks kind of whitish. Even when I look at my own hands. They look kind of whitish. It doesn't glow. These little guys, there are two of them in the room, the one other, oh, no, there are a few others over there against the walls, circled around. There are two guys who seem to be running the show. One is, the guy who came in with me, and there, they almost blend in with the white. I almost want to say that the air in the room is white also. Something strange about the color of everything. I don't know how to describe it. Everything is kind of milky or misty or something. It doesn't shine, but everything has almost that metallic kind of glow to it, including me, as I look at my legs and, I don't know where my clothes went. There is an obvious gap in his recall at this point, between his entering the room and finding himself nearly naked, seated on the table. AC. What are you wearing? SK, it looks like a wrap diaper of some sort, very soft. It's wrapped in a criss-cross. There's a thing over my head, it's coming out of the ceiling. It looks like it should be made of metal or something, but I can't tell if it is. It looks kind of like something I saw in a planetarium. a big thing. It has a kind of bulbous head on one end. It looks like a big insect. It's about twice the size of me. It's 9 feet long or so, and maybe 3 or 4 feet across. It's really intricate. There are all kinds of little, it's a gadget, whatever it is. Chuckles, at one end, there's like, I don't know if it's a needle, it looks like a fancy ray gun of some sort. I don't know what it is. And it's, like, on a pivotal point in the center of it, so it's suspended in the center. And it turns down by itself, they don't touch it. It turns so the needle part is pointing down towards me, and that's what runs along the bottom of my back. And I'm just sitting there, and when they put it against, A-C-S-K, my back, one don't know whether they're sticking something into my back, but it hurts. That's what hurt before. And the guy who brought me in is just sort of watching everything. He seems to know what's going on. The walls around the room are curved, so the inside of the room would be the shape of a saucer. Even the ceiling is curved. It's like a big oval. Yeah, the room is a big, circular, flattened, out oval. It has a really calming effect, being in this room. Chuckles, it's almost like being hypnotized. This is really, you almost feel as if you could float. It's very peaceful. And there is not a sound. Nothing. I think it's the quietest place I was ever in. This table is so, I don't know, it's like it grows out of the floor. It's perfectly smooth. The same color. There are no drawers or anything. No cabinets. No handles. Nothing. It's just like a pillar. And, it's a perfect temperature, so I'm perfectly comfortable. It's a flat kind of thing on the end, yeah, that's digging into my back. Whatever they're doing there, it's feeling the bone. On my back. Size, just touching my back. I don't know what it's doing there. It doesn't hurt now, it's not a needle. Feels like it would be almost as wide as my hand if my hand were flattened out. And, they take it off and it hurts when it comes off. And the thing goes back up into the ceiling. It's still up there, it doesn't go out of sight or anything. I can look straight up, directly over my head. In fact, I feel a little bit dizzy. My back hurts a little bit. All this time I've been sitting with my legs over the edge of this, I guess it's the doctor's table. Chuckles, it's one doctor's office I didn't have to wait to get into, I guess. Now I'm lying down on my right side. It's kind of a, oh. My back hurts. It's soft, where I put my head down and it moved up. The table itself moved up to support my head. It's very comfortable. Almost like a cushion or something. Inaudible, they're taking the thing I'm wearing off. Inaudible question. The other guy who was in the room when I walked in. And he's lifting it up with his hand. I didn't know they did anything with their hands. And it slides against my leg. Inaudible. These two are talking to each other, I mean, or they're communicating with each other, cause there's something going on between the two of them. They're looking at each other, oh. Why are they waiting until it starts hurting too? Inaudible. They're awfully interested in my back. I'm just lying there now, just, waiting for what's next. I think the joy has gone out of this relationship. It's not that interesting anymore. Sounds of pain. That thing has come down and it's pushing against my back again. It's pushing, at an edge, pushing against the lower, oh, whatever they hit, it's a version of the old hit your knee and see if it jumps up in the air, cause that's what my right leg did. Chuckles. They're testing my reflexes. Sighs, it hurts when they do it, too. Kind of a sharp edge. Oh. Sudden cry, that only makes my right leg twitch, wherever they're hitting, on my back. Oh, sighs, no, I'm really not that thrilled with being the now. I don't think they really care whether it hurts or not. And I, my back itches. I can feel it now. It itches now, too. AC, continue to breathe deeply. Instructions to calm the pain and end the itching. SK, inaudible, I'm lying there. My back is just kind of in dull pain, And, I think the guy who brought me in, the leader, I think he's getting impatient. He's kind of, he turns to look at where we came in.